This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Texas History Lessons, and with this episode, I'm going to be jumping back into the series that began a long while back as Lesson Zero, and it's kind of morphed into some interesting avenues that I've gone down, which leads to the subject of today. But before we get going, I heard from a listener that I've corresponded with a little bit. I've had some good feedback from him and some positive comments, Michael Sullinger, and he wrote to me after the episodes that were about Cleo's scroll and had some thoughts that he wanted to share, and it ties in with the subject matter that we're looking at today. He offered some very perceptive comments, and he suggested that the unseen part of the scroll is perhaps how history will be used by people once they learn about it or discover it. And he also added that the unknown part might be derivative of maybe not totally true facts, but evidence, and maybe incomplete or shallow research that fits a person's life compass or a group's agenda. They want to use, he wrote, history or a version of history or an interpretation of history to motivate or push their version, or he added, reversion, which is interesting comment. They want to push their version or reversion to influence their current time or view of how current circumstances should be, according to them. Now, these are some very interesting ideas, and I think you really hit on an important issue. It is also very serendipitous because, unbeknownst to him, this is the next topic that I was planning on investigating and covering with the podcast. He also wrote something that I also really think is worth considering. Basically, he said, history today seems to be weaponized for a modern or current society political goal. Perhaps it's always been that way. That, to me, might be a possible interpretation of the unseen part of the scroll. And it closed with a look to the future, saying, kind of a side thought to that is, I wonder if historians, while researching and writing history, ever wonder if future generations will take what they've researched and written and use it in some context they, the writer, don't know about, but have a sense it could happen. I could see the astute, forward-thinking historian choosing words and facts carefully as to not allow their history to be used or weaponized in a way that they don't intend or even try to ironclad their research to make the history unable to be twisted, if that's even possible. Very interesting food for thought, especially since I said I have been building towards this topic of activist history, the controversial book Forget the Alamo, some of the hullabaloo that surrounded the 1836 project from a while back, and, you know, the question of bias and the ethics of history. I've looked closely at the question of rewriting history and the reasons for revisionist history to a great extent to show that there is really nothing that new about it. And I've done this because I believe it is very important. The great historian and biographer of Sam Houston, James Haley, wrote, everything that you believe in this world that's important, what's right, what's wrong, what's moral, what's immoral, how should you live, vote, worship, raise your children. Everything you believe filters like coffee through what you ever understood about history or not. It's not something you walk out and make a living with, but it informs everything about what kind of human being you are. Apart from a command of language, history is the most important thing you can know. I think that's just spot on and perfect what he wrote there. Now, as for the earlier topic about different writing and rewriting of history, I found another early recognition of this understanding in the introductory note to the volume on American historical documents in the Harvard Classics. And it was first published in 1910, and it was edited and published by Harvard University President Charles L. Eliot. Now, the author of this introduction, he wrote, "No final history of the United States of America has been written or is likely to be written. Research is constantly bringing to light new facts that correct details or modify the traditional view of larger questions. And the most impartial historian is subject to personal or sectional bias, which leads to his works being regarded as imperfect by another generation or as unfair by the people of parts of the country other than his own." And this was seen and understood in 1910. And I found another good example from the past about rewriting history and the many different interpretations of it. And this one comes from one of my favorite authors, Jorge Luis Borges. Borges was, for lack of a better term, a fan of Thomas De Quincey, an earlier writer. And Borges, in an essay on historian Edward Gibbon, he wrote, "De Quincey writes that history is an infinite discipline, or at least an indefinite one, as the same events may be combined or interpreted in many ways. This observation dates from the 19th century. Since then, interpretations have expanded under the influence of the evolution of psychology, while previously unsuspected cultures and civilizations have been exhumed." And as I've pointed out many times before, there have been and will always be disagreement over the analysis and interpretation of historical events. Texas history legend Walter P. Webb agreed, and he wrote, "Discussion can never proceed without disagreement, and that is all to the good. As long as the views expressed are reasonable and to the point, interpretations and interpreters are fallible because the interpreter is a fallible human being. But no interpretation has ever had universal acceptance, and none should. It is those who differ who correct history and keep the subject alive. An interpretation has another value in that it gives to those who accept it a frame of reference, a place to take off from, and to come back to in trying to understand the past." And I found that quote on page 52 of his book, An Honest Preface. So, if rewriting history and changing ideas and challenging interpretations is not really an issue and never has been, what do we do with the problems we face today? At the heart of some of the recent Texas State Historical Association controversy were complaints about activist historians. What about the question of activist historians? Are they a part of some new threatening conspiracy to warp the minds of our young people? Are academic historians a dangerous cabal? I don't think so. That's just my personal opinion. There might be some, what somebody might call, bad apples in the bunch that aren't applying history in a historical method and ethical history. But in a normal fashion, I decided to look at the question fairly and look to the past for evidence. A while back, someone on the app formerly known as Twitter shared the following, quote, "The trap historians often fall into, converting the episodes of the past into mere counters to be deployed on the checkerboard of contemporary controversies." And that was a quote by author Richard Hofstadter from 1968. Now, as we tend to do, this led to some people commenting on how it is a problem of the present with social activists, historians, etc., that are using their agenda to try to influence things, which is correct. The drawback for jumping to that conclusion, though, is that Hofstadter was speaking not of today or of 1968 when this was published, but he was talking about a time several decades earlier. The full quote in context reads, "Both the conservative nationalist historians of the Gilded Age and the progressive historians of Charles A. Beard's generation sometimes fell into this trap, converting the episodes of the past into mere counters to be deployed on the checkerboard of contemporary controversies." That's evidence enough alone. Perhaps what the issue for some people is not that it's being done or has been done before. Maybe it's the topics and subject matter that these activist historians are pursuing and pushing. And that is a fair criticism and something to be interested in and explored. It should come as no surprise, but the existence of what we call activist historians is not quite a new phenomenon. People have, for an eternity, used history for their own purposes. I hinted at this earlier when quoting Frederick Jackson Turner in a previous episode. Turner recognized that ideology was and had been prevalent in history. He wrote, "To a large class of writers, represented by Hume, the field of historical writing is an arena whereon are to be fought out present partisan debates. Whig is to struggle against Tory, and the party of the writer's choice is to be victorious at whatever cost to the truth. We do not lack these partisan historians in America." And remember, he was writing well over 100 years ago, and that was still happening then. Now, a lot of people agree that the historian's task as an ideal is not to weigh in on political questions of the present. That's what a lot of people believe. But that is the ideal. Real life operates differently, and that doesn't mean that historians can't or don't become active in political and social and cultural questions of the present. Many do. But in doing so, they are walking this razor's edge of being a practicing historian or a political or social creature. Many historians would agree that the purpose of the historian is to quote Jack Nicholson, not the actor, a historian, Jack Nicholson, quote, "to speak for something, the truth, the voice of the past. If they want to be politicians," he said, "then good luck to them. However, historians, especially historians in public life, have a different task to perform." Historian Jeffrey Elton said the historian should be like a good glove turned inside out. They should be, quote, "humble outwardly and proud inwardly. People around the world want quick fix solutions to the problems of the world." And Elton said that if they wanted to fulfill the role of prophet, then, quote, "we as historians can most certainly, if we want to, cash in on that. Historians," he and others argue, "should rather be focused on what they are good at, focusing on the past." Elton stated that, quote, "it is not a question of finding an answer to the future or planning the future, of settling the future for the world." And Nicholson added, "it is a question of encouraging better thought about past, present, and future, of focusing on the past and being changed by it." I especially like this next line by Nicholson, who said, "historians should tell us, if anything, to stop and think. We should be challenged and humbled by the past before acting. Historians should, quote, dig very deep and go back to original sources and first principles, go back in the cell, in order to turn the crisis into a creative moment. That is the task which they have to perform," end quote. This however, is an idealistic goal, and as is often the case, hard to live up to, no matter how dedicated you try to be to remaining focused on it. Now, there are people that are proudly activist historians. You know, while researching them, I came across a South African proverb that said, until lions write books, history will always glorify the hunter. Activist historians often see themselves as stepping in for the lions, the hunted, the oppressed, and the at times ignored. In a paper from back in 1998 for the Institute for Cultural Activism, Aurora Levins Morales wrote in a paper called The Historian as Curandera, one of the first things a colonizing power or repressive regime does is to attack the sense of history of those they wish to dominate and attempt to take over and control people's relationships to their own past. Morales also wrote, official history is designed to make sense of oppression, to say that the oppressed are oppressed because it is their nature to be oppressed. A strong sense of their own history among the oppressed undermines the project of domination because it provides an alternative story, one in which oppression is a result of events and choices, not natural law. Imperial histories also fulfill a vital role for those who rule. Then Morales later added, quote, in his 1976 essay, Defensa de la Palabra, Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, who's a great writer, he wrote, what process of change can move a people that does not know who it is, nor where it came from? If it doesn't know who it is, how can it know what it deserves to be? The role of a socially committed historian is to use history not so much to document the past as to restore to the dehistoricized a sense of identity and possibility. Such medicinal histories seek to reestablish the connections between peoples and their histories, to reveal the mechanisms of power, the steps by which their current condition of oppression was achieved, through a series of decisions made by real people to dispossess them, but also to reveal the multiplicity, creativity, and persistence of resistance among the oppressed. History is the story we tell ourselves about how the past explains our present, and the ways in which we tell the story are shaped by contemporary needs. Now, this is a statement to which some might vehemently disagree. Others champion it. One more long quote from Morales. All historians have points of view. All of us use some process of selection through which we choose which stories we consider important and interesting. We construct history from some perspective within some particular worldview. Storytelling is not neutral. Curandera historians make this explicit, openly naming our partisanship, our intent to influence how people think. Many that are critical of activist historians, I'll add, would agree with much of this last statement. The one thing that I want to point out that is significant is that activist historians are honest about the fact that they do intend to influence how people think. That's fine, the way I consider it and look at it. As long as you're honest and open and you follow historical method, the problem is when people don't use proper historical method or they try to manipulate things to fit a particular goal. Now, this is not a new thought. Carter G. Woodson wrote in The Miseducation of the Negro back in 1933, when you control a man's thinking, you don't have to worry about his actions. And I'll add, some activist historians see great meaning in the following quote by Czech novelist Milan Kundera in his book from 1980, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting. And he wrote, the first step in liquidating a people is to erase its memory, destroy its books, its culture, its history. then have somebody write new books, manufacture a new culture, invent a new history. Before long, that nation will begin to forget what it is and what it was. The struggle of man against power is a struggle of memory against forgetting. And this kind of points at the real problem here. People are afraid that what's being promoted as history is destroying the history that they grew up with. And the myth and mystique that they believe in. As opposed on the other side, people that embrace the work of activist historians feel that's what's been done to them. Raina Araibi, a Mexican-American activist, wrote that activist historians recognize, quote, the power that history has in inspiring current generations of activists not only to better understand their positionality in the world, but also to see that oppression continues today in many of the same forms it has in the past. Moreover, they taught and embody the responsibility we each have to pick up the baton of resistance left to us by our ancestors. As Dr. Daniel Black said, the blood has demands. She continued, we are required to be activists to improve the condition of oppressed communities in the United States and internationally, but also to honor and understand the groundwork that has been laid by so many that have come before us. Without knowing this history, history of and by people of color, it is far too easy to detach activism from the real world and forget one's responsibilities to the blood. Education is inextricably linked to freedom. And in a world where human rights are constantly being attacked or denied, we need this type of radical education. We need ethnic studies to cultivate leaders who understand and can navigate cultural crises. If you want to know more about the perspectives of activist historians, you can visit activisthistory.com and read articles from the Activist History Review. On that website, I found something in which Corey James Young broke down activist histories into four subgroups. And they are histories of activists, histories for activists, histories inspired by activists, and histories that are activist. And Young's personal favorite type of activist history is, quote, any kind of constructive public history project that makes your present landscape better reflect your past. For example, getting new historical markers erected about activist history itself. Activist historians are not necessarily new. Some are not so open about their goals, and others that are labeled as activist historians are just people that the labeler disagrees with. Lucy Maynard Salmon, who lived from 1853 to 1927, was a historian and actively worked for causes in civic affairs. She worked for civic service reform, and she worked for world and women's suffrage. William E. Dodd, a historian who lived from 1869 to 1940 and who had strong influence on Texas historian Walter P. Webb, probably shouldn't be labeled as an activist historian. And maybe most of these shouldn't be. But he caused quite a stir with his beliefs, though he was the first college or university professor who devoted his work fully to the history of the American South. He wasn't afraid to go against the norm and attack Southern aristocratic values and the lost cause. Back in 1902, Dodd wrote about the pressure he faced to flatter Southern elites and their view that slavery played no role in the onset of the Civil War. But Dodd was bold enough to go so far as criticizing the Grand Camp of Confederate veterans by name. This led for many concerned citizens and groups to call for his dismissal. Dodd would not back down and wrote to suggest that the revolt from the Union in 1860 was not justified, was not led by the most lofty-minded statesman is to invite not only criticism, but an enforced resignation. Mentioned Charles A. Beard earlier. Beard lived from 1874 to 1948, and he was a pretty influential historian whose 1913 book, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States, might qualify him as promoting a particular view or perspective. And if he was alive today pushing his ideas, he might get labeled as an activist historian. The book argued for that the structure of the Constitution was an act to protect the financial interests of the founding fathers, and that ideology was a product of economic interests, a view that would definitely earn him the title of activist historian, I think. Now, Oklahoma-born John Hope Franklin. He lived from 1915 to 2009, and he probably could be called an activist historian as well. He served on the NAACP Legal Defense Fund team in the 1950s and helped develop the case for Brown versus Board of Education. The National Endowment for the Humanities selected Franklin for the Jefferson Lecture in 1976, and this selection is the United States federal government's highest honor for achievement in the humanities. Eric Hobsbawm, who lived from 1917 to 2012, was a British historian of the rise of industrial capitalism, socialism, and nationalism. And I've looked at his books. I haven't gone into great detail and gone through all of them. But from what I can tell, he's a pretty thorough historian. But he was also a lifelong Marxist, and his socio-political beliefs were evident in his work. The politically conservative Spectator magazine, which began back in the 1820s, said in 2002 that Hobsbawm was, quote, arguably our greatest living historian, not only Britain's, but the world's. But the key to this, I think, I'll add again, is he did his work with his own views, but he was upfront about what his views were. Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr., who was also born in 1917 and he lived until 2007, he could definitely also be considered an activist historian due to his close ties to the Democratic Party, Adlai Stevenson, and the Kennedys, and he did some of the great work on the Jacksonian era. One of his books, I remember a couple of them in college, I was instructed to read, and it was a good historical work. But he publicly had goals that he promoted. Gerda Lerner, who lived from 1920 to 2013, was a historian who helped start the academic field of women's history back in the 1960s. E.P. Thompson lived from 1924 to 1993. He was an English activist historian that was named the second most important historian of the previous 60 years behind only Fernand Braudel in a 2011 poll by History Today. In addition to being a historian, he was also a socialist and a peace campaigner. And we cannot omit Howard Zinn from this list, who lived from 1922 to 2010. He was definitely an activist historian, and most of you that have watched Good Will Hunting will have heard about his 1980 book, A People's History of the United States. He had a point of view, an agenda, and a perspective he wanted you to see from in his work. And without it, you no doubt might not have had such conservative activist histories. On the other side, like Michael Allen and Larry Schweikart's 2004 A Patriot's History of the United States, whose title is definitely a nod to Zinn and his work. And let's not forget the great Texas-born historian Forrest McDonald Jr., who lived from 1927 to 2016. While he might not have been an activist historian, his work could arguably reflect his own ideological bias, a more conservative bias. Doesn't mean that his work wasn't good. No. So activist historians and bias in historical work might not be a new thing, but it appears that much of the current issue regarding activist academic historians might be rooted in the revisionism that came about, some argue, as a result of the radicalism of the 1960s. Modern revisionism's roots go back much more, of course, but the politically correct revisionism that my hero, Elmer Kelton, spoke about and spoke out against a lot had much to do with the development of what is called the new social history in the 1960s and 1970s. It includes, among other things, focuses on historical demography, African-American history, ethnic history, labor history, women's history, gender history, urban history, history of the family, and so on. Back in 2002, Eric Foner, who's another great historian whose work I've appreciated, he wrote in his book, Who Owns History? And he said, quote, "Today, when we take for granted that history must include the experience of previously neglected groups, blacks, women, laborers, and others, it is difficult to recapture the sense of intellectual excitement produced by the work of E.P. Thompson, Eric Hobsbawm, and other British practitioners of history from below. Thanks to what came to be called the new social history, which they inspired, we today have a far more complex and nuanced portrait of the American past in all its diversity and contentiousness." And in that book, he celebrated the fact that the profession had weathered the storm of fighting over politically correct revisionist history in the 90s. He was celebrating back then that they had managed to get through this term and time of political correctness that Kelton talked about and others. But fast forward to today, and everything seems very similar to that decade. What is old is new again. We're still having these differences of opinions. We still have conflicts. We still have problems. And as I said before, I am a huge fan of Elmer Kelton. I regret that I let some lazy, opinionated writing by another person a few years ago, who I also respect, but they helped keep me from reading his work for a long time. I've listened to several of his speeches as well, and I also found a wonderful little book collecting some of his speeches titled My Kind of Heroes. And in it, he shared his thoughts on the importance of history and his issues with what he called politically correct chauvinism in the history of the 90s. And here are some excerpts from that book. Kelton said, "I think the statement I always liked best was on the day he solemnly declared, things just ain't like they used to be, and I don't think they ever was. Things on farms and ranches today aren't like they used to be. And in some ways, they probably never were like the stories or like people want to remember them or imagine that they were. For one thing, they probably never were any really good old days in the ranching and farming business. Almost anybody can tell you his own version of the good old days. You'll usually find that they were when he was young and not necessarily when the business was in a state of prosperity. Listen closely to the stories about the good old days, and you'll usually discover that people suffered a lot of hardships. Part of their pride in those good old days is that they survived." I like that part especially. And another part, he said, "We have a habit of glamorizing the past and imagining that it was better than it was. It may have had its compensations, but it wasn't like the image we see when we look through the rose-colored glasses of a creative memory." And he also said, "I guess knowing so many of those old stories told by the people who live them has helped color the kind of fiction I write. I can't write about heroes 7 feet tall and invincible. I write about people 5'8" and nervous. To me, those are the real heroes. They fight their battles a day at a time. They do the best they can think of. And if that doesn't work, they try something else. Most of all, they hang on and endure." Now, when it came to myth, now, Kelton said this, "I don't trust the word myth. To me, myth has always meant something not quite real, not quite true. It bothers me when learned academics in their Eastern ivory towers write or speak about the myth of the Old West or the myth of the cowboy. To me, this implies that they were never actually real. And he also said, I don't know just where we separate myth and image. Perhaps we don't. They may be essentially the same. And he said this about the academics. Meanwhile, he, in other writings and speeches, he uses the word myth about the past. I think we should all agree that there is a widely accepted image of the Texan, Kelton said, outside of Texas. It persists in other parts of the world, certainly in Europe. Speak the word Texas and it conjures up an image of a cowboy on horseback with a desert mountain and an oil well behind him and a saguaro cactus. How that saguaro got in there, I don't know. Arizona could probably sue. We Texans have an image. It is not always the one we would like, but sometimes perceptions are more important than facts, at least in the way they make people react to us. And the truth of fiction, Kelton said, the history of this country is the story of people who had very little except hope. On the basis of that hope, they built for us the country we have today with all its faults and all its virtues. He also, in another one called Politically Correct or Historically Correct, he said, theoretically, history should be locked in concrete. The things that happened happened, and that should be that. But of course, it doesn't work that way. Now, this is Kelton saying it doesn't work that way. If two people witness a fender bender from opposite sides of the street, they see and remember the incident differently. Historical events very often were seen in a different way by the people who witnessed them. So later historians have to pick their way through a minefield of ambiguities and contradictions. Moreover, he also said, interpretations of history mutate as the years go by and fashions change. Today, we often see historical correctness take a back seat to political correctness. He said, in earlier times, writers, including historians, as well as the general public, tended to glorify the history of the West, of Texas, the accomplishments of our forebears. Today, it has become much more fashionable to condemn granddad and great-granddad for a multitude of sins, real or assumed. In an earlier time, we were looking for heroes. It is a mark of today's deep-rooted cynicism that we tend more often now to look for villains. We seem to find them in the same places and in the same people where we used to find heroes. Now, Kelton also had this to say, we are all products of what has gone before. We live where we live because of the things that have happened in our past and to those who preceded us. The way we live, the things we believe in, are all rooted in the times, the beliefs, the histories of our parents, our grandparents, and many, many generations before them. History is a part of the present and the future. It is ongoing. There is a continuity between yesterday and today and tomorrow. If we are to understand what is happening around us today, and just as important to have any valid vision of tomorrow, we have to understand yesterday. We have to know our history. Mark Twain once declared that history is a lie agreed upon. The problem is that historians today don't agree upon very much. And Kelton also continued and said, we have a class of revisionists, historians and other writers who have taken the history we used to agree upon and stood it on its head. They have sought villains where we used to seek heroes, and they have found them in granddad and our Euro-American ancestors. There is a dark side to history. All of it was not written in the light, but those who seek it only in the warts or in terms of the warts are as one-sided as those who see only the glory. And I think he hit the nail on the head right there. There has to be, to go back from episode long way back, there has to be balance. To focus only on the negative, to beat people up over the negative, doesn't accomplish much. It doesn't accomplish a lot to just focus on all the good and the glory and the heroes. That's not what history's for. That's something else. That's another thing, the Texas thing you wrestle with when you're dealing with the Texas history. is you come up against this big wall that there's a lot more mixed in with it that's hard to separate. And, you know, Kelton said that he had no quarrel with those who say that, quote, we need to make Western history broader. Kelton agreed. He agreed with the work of writer like Patricia Limerick. And he said, when they say that in the past we have often not given sufficient attention to racial and ethnic minorities, Kelton agreed with that. And he also said, I don't remember during my youth reading a great deal about the contribution of women in the history of the West, though there were already a number of books around had they been called to my attention. Fortunately, women and ethnic minorities have come in for much more attention by writers in recent decades. And Kelton, another great quote from him, past omissions continue to be corrected. The literature is there now if we choose to seek it out, and some of these books are by no means new. They have been out there a long time for those who wanted to find them. So perhaps the past omissions have been less severe than some of today's revisionists would tell us as they try to load us up with guilt. And guilt is what they are peddling, but they are selective in placing their blame. They would put all of it on our white male ancestors of European origin or ancestry. They seem blind to fault in anyone else. And Kelton also said, I do not intend to paint our forebears as plaster saints. They were not. They were human beings with the same human virtues and faults that we share today. They were no better and no worse than we. Kelton believed, and I do have to agree quite a bit with him, what he wanted to see was a sense of balance in viewing our history, in contrast to the narrow, one-sided, guilt-ridden revisionist view we have so often witnessed in recent times. Now, that was his words, what he was saying. And he also said, true, many past writers in glorifying the early Western experience glossed over the hardships suffered by the pioneers, and they often did not acknowledge that each gain made by the newcomers meant a loss to the people who were already there. For the average person who went west in the 1800s, life is hard and it never softened up much. The reality fell far short of the dream. Glamour and romance were in the eyes of the later beholders. An old-timer once declared, I'm not one who longs for the good old days. I was there. And Kelton also pointed out that many of today's revisionist writers are not true historians in the academic sense. Very often, when you analyze their writings, you find an agenda that has more to do with changing today's political landscape than with correcting the wrongs committed by our ancestors. That is applicable today, and I'm not criticizing people that want to be activist historians. I think more power to them. If they have something they believe in, they pursue it. As long as they pursue good historical method and ethic to it, and, you know, be honest with what their goals are. Now I could go on and on about Kelton and what he said and thought, and, you know, I probably have gone on too far, but I loved the man's writing. I loved the way he thought, and I liked the way he looked at history. One last quote from him. If you listen to the generational chauvinist, to the politically correct, you would think it all began with Granddad, that he was the serpent who spoiled the Garden of Eden. And that's talking about all the hardships and prejudices and wrongs in the history from the dawn of time. And that's perspective. Kelton's perspective there, I think, is the perspective that many people have today against activist historians. And that's why I think it's important to have honest discussion about where you're coming from with the work, what you're doing. Kelton just as well could have been speaking today about what's going on.
You are listening to Texas History Lessons, a slow walk through Texas history made in Texas by a Texan for everyone everywhere.
I prefer to believe that man is greater than the dangers that menace him, that education and science are powerful forces to change these tendencies and to produce a rational solution of the problems of life on a shrinking planet. That was written by Frederick Jackson Turner, published in 1924. perspective in the past really does reflect a lot of what we're facing today. In a 1995 issue of the American Historical Review, you know, I just mentioned how Kelton appreciated the work of Patricia Nelson Limerick. Well, in 1995, Limerick gave attention to the chipping away at Turner's 1893 frontier thesis and explored deeply into the man and his work in her writing, and her conclusion is especially valuable. In the 1890s, she also pointed out Turner embraced presentism and over time betrayed it as younger generations of historians sought to stir things up. What is old is new again. Younger generations have always challenged the older generation, even back in Turner's time. She wrote, "Under these circumstances, the point cannot be to chide him for a failure of self-consciousness. The point is to learn from his example and to use it as an occasion to ask ourselves, what are our blind spots? What are the elements of our social identity that limit our vision as sternly as racial assumptions limited Turner's vision? However we answer these questions, historians of the late 20th century have not reached a plateau of comfortable self-understanding from which we can look down smugly on Turner's struggles. In truth, a confession of solidarity, Turnerians all, is the place where this exploration begins and ends." Limerick continued and added, quote, "Squabbles over the validity of the frontier thesis have distracted us from the more compelling issue raised by Turner's example. Frederick Jackson Turner embodied the idea of historian as public servants. As scholars whose inquiries into the past could contribute directly and concretely to human well-being in the present, the familiar dispute, was Turner right about the frontier, has become trivial and arcane. The much less familiar question, was Turner right about the present-day value of historical understanding, remains the question of consequence. In everyday life, that question has been pushed to the edge of our attention by the constant round of activities of the professional historian, activities rendered normal by the careers of Turner and his contemporaries, class preparing, lecture giving, discussion leading, paper grading, student advising, archive exploring, note-taking, book reviewing, manuscript evaluating, article and book writing, job search conducting, convention attending, paper presenting, critic answering, professional association office holding, and turf defending. In the midst of the business and busyness of professional historians, the question of the purpose and goal of these activities, a question from which Turner did not try to hide, awaits our answer." I think that's a good spot to wrap it up and put an end to it for this episode. I could continue on. I probably could have used an editor on this one. Got a little bit carried away on some of it. But I'm still headed towards an idea that I'm wrestling with and trying to get to. And the point is, again, always be I'm being straightforward about where I'm coming from and the process I'm following for this. And I think that's the key, is to always be aware of what is the perspective of the people that are feeding you information. Do they have an agenda? I'm pretty straightforward. I am biased, but I try to limit my biases in the presentation of the information, because I think the information has value just in itself. I don't talk politics on the podcast, and I'm not going to. Maybe someday I'll change my mind on that, but this is just a start. We'll be getting to where I'm leading up to the ethics of history and things like that in the next episode. With that said, thanks for listening. Thanks to Derek McLennan for providing the theme music. Go check out his music if you get an opportunity. You'll love it. And yeah, that's it. We'll be back soon with more history and Texas history talk. And take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Be kind. Adios.